The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline, It's Not Okay, Ever. Lawyers, corporations brace for a rise in workplace sexual harassment claims. There's no evidence of a spike yet in the Triangle, but that does not mean misbehavior is not prevalent. And that's the headline on the front page. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline. Attention is intense, but sexual harassment cases are not rising. And this article is written by Jennifer Henderson. In 2014, when Ursula Mead started it, In Her Site, an online website designed to allow women to rate employers, essentially a glass door for working women, little did she know that her website would play such an important role in forwarding the conversation about sexual harassment in the workplace. Today, as Mead says, women are coming forward in droves to complain about workplace conditions in the Triangle and beyond. Sexual harassment is a reality at all three of the stores I've worked at. It has never been properly dealt with or validated. I've been told to accept it as a compliment and do my job, one woman wrote in her site. Another user wrote her workplace promotes harassment of women and that the CEO is telling women to dress in a way that is not distracting to men. As for complaints, the user posted, human resources staff are unresponsive. While these posts mention the company similar to Glassdoor, the reviewers remain anonymous. We've definitely noticed an increase in the number of comments on the site that reference sexual harassment and use the hashtag MeToo, says Mead, whose site is based in Durham. From Harvey Weinstein to the MeToo movement, the nation has cast a watchful eye on predators, both in the workplace and beyond, as many women have shared their stories of workplace harassment. However, there are many more who have not, which makes it difficult to know how widespread the problem really is. One reason for the silence is the common use of non-disclosure agreements in the settlement of sexual harassment claims. These agreements bar victims from speaking about their experiences, and some states, such as California, have proposed doing away with such agreements, as many argue they allow harassment to be kept secret and continue. While the attention on the issue has changed, the challenges facing women who have been harassed remain daunting in the workforce and in the courtroom, and that's why many in the legal and corporate realms are unconvinced that the attention will lead to real change for workers far removed from the glaring lights of Hollywood and high-profile endeavors such as media and politics. Most victims of sexual harassment, primarily women, stay silent or move jobs if possible. Only about 10% of harassment claims ever get reported, internally at the company or externally to the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Campbell Law professor Melissa Essery says that means that 90% of sexual harassment never is reported. Suppressed statistics. In fact, according to the EEOC, nationwide there were 6,696 charges alleging sexual harassment last year. That's down from 6,758 in 2016, 6,822 in 2015, and just shy of 8,000 back in 2010. That pattern held true in North Carolina, where there were 231 charges last year, down from 265 in 2016, 296 in 2015, and 370 back in 2010. And even now, lawyers across the state who work in this field say there is no groundswell of allegations headed toward the courts. According to a search of federal court filings in North Carolina, there are 14 active cases alleging some form of job discrimination based on sex, including sexual harassment, 4 in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina, 1 in the Middle District, and 9 in the Western District. Of those, half involve claims of sexual harassment in the workplace. Little movement following spotlight. The drop in allegations can be surprising, given the attention to the matter, but experts point to a variety of reasons. One is that women, when the economy is strong, simply change jobs to get away from the harassment. The fact that allegations both in the U.S. and North Carolina were higher in 2010, at the height of the recession, than now, underscores that point. For victims who do want to fight, pursuing resolution remains daunting. They're faced with challenges that include limited legal remedies, significant costs, and even a lingering stigma. Often the most impacted victims of sexual harassment work for minimum wage and have limited options outside of the place where they are being harassed when it comes to earning the income they need to support their families. The vast majority of people bringing sexual harassment charges through the EEOC locally are minimum wage workers from rural parts of the state. And the fact that so much harassment is not reported is problematic. Most sexual harassers are serial harassers, and so the lack of reporting allows them to offend repeatedly, Essery says. But one can hardly blame the women at the workplace who don't complain. Of those 10% who complain of sexual harassment, almost 90% of them are retaliated against by their employer. Reporting any type of harassment often labels the victim as a complainer or whiner, when all the victim really wants is a job without being harassed. Josh Van Campen, a Charlotte lawyer, says that sexual harassment work comprises about a quarter of casework at his firm. That amount of work has been a steady drumbeat since he started practicing back in 2004. Like many, he expected an uptick in complaints as the Me Too spread, hashtag Me Too spread. We actually haven't seen one, he says. At the same time, he adds, the overwhelming majority of women don't report the cases internally or go to a lawyer because it's such an intensely private matter, and women can blame themselves for what happened. Vulnerable from lack of employment options, some have been preyed upon by harassers who know their victims need the cash and can get away with making inappropriate demands backed by demeaning promises of being hired and of not being fired. Typically, more sexual harassment cases occur in which women hold low-wage jobs, such as the food services industry and retail, says Campbell's Essery, adding that blue-collar women in manufacturing industries that used to be the preserve of men also suffer disproportionately from harassment. It's about power. Attorney Chris Stranese from Charlotte says industries more notorious for sexual harassment tend to be male-dominated. They are also industries where there's a lot of money at stake and people get big heads about it. Repeat offenders include construction, software, and finance companies, Stranese says. Others note restaurants and car dealerships, both known for fast talk and high turnover. A high bar for cases. While some violations of the law may seem unquestionable, the bar is set high and may not be applicable at all for many small businesses. Under Title 7, federal law governs sexual harassment, and there are precedent-setting cases that show just how difficult it is to win an already uphill battle. Laura Noble, a Chapel Hill lawyer, points to two cases in particular. In Oakletree versus Skolin, male employees at a costume manufacturing company simulated sexual acts on mannequins, sang graphic songs, and bragged about their sexual exploits, all while awaiting reaction from a female employee. In 2002, a jury found that the female employee was the victim of sexual harassment under Title VII, awarding her $7,280 in compensatory damages and $400,000 in punitive damages, which was reduced to just under $43,000. Shortly after, the panel members of the Fourth Circuit Appellate Court vacated the jury verdict, but reversed the punitive damages, finding that much of the behavior was not aimed at her because of her sex and was not severe enough to create a hostile work environment. The following year, the appellate court vacated that decision. It affirmed the verdict for compensatory damages, but reversed the punitive damages, finding the company did not have knowledge of the behavior. In the case of Hernandez versus Fairfax County, a female firefighter claimed a male coworker repeatedly positioned his body against hers when she told him not to, told other coworkers she was having an affair, and repeatedly forced her to maneuver around him. The district court found last year that the behavior was neither severe nor pervasive enough to be sexual harassment. Earlier this year, those findings were reversed by the appellate court, with the case set to go to a jury trial. The challenge in small businesses. Another challenge for victims of sexual harassment is that Title VII applies to employers who have 15 or more employees, a huge problem for victims of sexual harassment in many small businesses. In such cases, victims and their counsel must look to limited options for remedy under state law. One option under state law is to sue for battery, notes Van Campen. However, while there is a 3-year statute of limitations on such cases, it fails to address verbal harassment. A second option is to sue for intentional infliction of emotional distress, which is hard to prove, he says. The cases settled out of court, which he says is about 85%, usually have a non-disclosure agreement. If the harasser is not terminated, the conduct might continue for more victims who are unaware what awaits them. The most difficult challenge is that sexual harassment cases often come down to he said, she said, Strianese says. And another challenge, he says, is that the company attitude can be the person was just joking around. But it doesn't matter if the intention was malicious, Strianese says, if what was done here was improper and is making someone uncomfortable and violates the law. Corporate lawyers cite better training. What lawyers are seeing, if not a flood of cases, is a rise in companies seeking training in the matter. In the past, the training was done primarily to limit legal liability. Raleigh attorney Randy Abrams says, the training we're doing more recently, it will have impact on your legal liability, but should also have the benefit of making your workplace a better workplace, including in the area of retention. In her sites, Mead says employer responsiveness to sexual harassment concerns is the second most powerful driver of a woman's overall satisfaction at work. In fact, employer responsiveness is more than three times as important to women than paid time off policies and five times more important than a company's family growth support initiatives. There is much work to be done. Noble of Noble Law says she hears backlash regarding recent attention on the issue of sexual harassment. That backlash has included people saying there are those who are trying to be relationship police and are taking romance out of the workplace. Sexual harassment is not one employee asking another for a cup of coffee and the other refusing, she points out. It is severe and persistent and impacts a person's employment, and there are strict federal guidelines to govern this. Sustaining the workforce. Molly Damaris, director of Big Top, an online platform and events company in association with American Underground, says that if work environments aren't healthy, it becomes a retention situation. Employees want to know whether businesses are places where they can thrive in advance, she says. My observation is the more we talk about it, the better, she says. She and others would like to see more men involved in public discussions. Essery of Campbell Law says the lack of uptick in sexual harassment charges could change if the movement takes hold in the ordinary workplace, and not just Hollywood. Think the equivalent of the power of the suffragette movement, where both women and men march for change. Essery concludes. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Local leaders pack their bags for Seattle, not for Amazon. More than 155 people already have signed up for the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce's annual Inner City Trip, April 22. This year's destination, Seattle. Chamber officials are quick to point out that this trip was arranged before the Amazon HQ2 announcement of the area making the top 20 cut. But Biz thinks Amazon may also be the reason so many people are interested in this trip, the largest contingent ever for an inner city visit. From WakeMed CEO Don Gintzig, PNC Regional Head Jim Hansen, to Raleigh Mayor Nancy McFarland, the contingent is heavy on local city and county officials and representatives from the education sector. Biz hears the agenda for the three-day trip includes talking to Seattle officials about public transit, economic development policy, and managing urban growth. More than 1,000 people move to the Seattle area each week compared to the Triangle's 500-plus, according to the U.S. Census. So from Biz's perspective, Seattle is a perfect choice to see what is working and perhaps ignite our public transit efforts before we become Tampa. The Seattle trip is starting with some fun thanks to Steve Malik, owner of the North Carolina Football Club. He coordinated an effort to host the contingent at a Seattle Sounders Major League Soccer game, April 22. Note to Malik, get firm commitments from those on the trip for some legislative and corporate support when it comes time to make another run for an MLS franchise. Just saying. What the governor really loves in the executive mansion. Governor Roy Cooper, in a recent interview with Triangle Business Journal, joked how someone had recently asked him about his favorite artifact at the Swank Executive Mansion. And there's plenty to like at the roomy Blunt Street Digs, with oriental rugs and paintings of past governors and all sorts of trinkets around. But Cooper quipped that his favorite artifact was over the mantle in the paneled study, a basketball signed by the UNC Chapel Hill team that won the national title. That ball was proudly displayed on top of a vase. And sure enough, there was another vase on the other end of the mantle, but no luck in adding a basketball this year. UNC, as well as Duke University and NC State University, are out as the Final Four beckons. Kids get an early start on career options. It's never too early to get a kid thinking about potential career options. At least that's the idea behind Students at Work, a state program that gets students out of the classroom and onto the job site for a little hands-on learning. For students, the week-long program provides a glimpse at possible careers. Companies participate partly to give back to the community, but it's also good for future employee recruitment prospects. We want to build our workforce in the future, and if students aren't aware of these jobs, they're not going to be preparing for them or even applying for them, says Casey Ford, Duke Energy Community Relations Manager and a coordinator of the Students at Work event. Duke Energy brought nearly 100 students from three schools in Durham, Lowe's Grove Middle School and Hillside and Southern High Schools, to the company's Durham Operations Center over the course of 2 days, where they toured the facility, watched a bucket truck in action, and heard from a general manager, the vice president of regulatory affairs, a member of the company's general counsel, and line techs. Students also got to check out electric vehicles, including a Tesla, courtesy of Durham City Councilman Charlie Reese, who loaned it to Duke Energy for the program. Raleigh man finds success on Kickstarter for pet treat company. A Raleigh tech entrepreneur's big pivot is paying off on Kickstarter. Justin Miller, who recently sold wedding-focused photo-sharing app WedPix, just secured the support of 109 backers for something completely different, dog treats. Miller's Zookies Cookies exceeded its $25,000 goal, with $26,098 raised on Kickstarter as of March 27. The company makes and sells dog treat mixes. Just add water and bake. Ex-governor joins board of online university. Nonprofit online university WGU North Carolina and its Night Owl mascot has been busy beefing up the school's advisory board, including adding a former North Carolina governor. According to the World Economic Forum, we are in a world where 65% of today's students will work in jobs that don't exist today, said Bev Perdue. She said WGU is helping retool the future workforce. Other new board members include Lou Ebert, president and CEO of the North Carolina Chamber, Jim Gibson, Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of RTI International, and Maria Petrie Martin, Deputy State Superintendent for the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction. WGU North Carolina, a partnership between the state and Western Governors University, launched in October, and enrollment has risen to about 1,600 students. Love passionately and other lessons from a leader. Sally Shooping Russell took her UNC Chapel Hill and Columbia University Business School degrees to a perch as managing director and senior advisor at BlackRock. So Biz paid close attention when she spoke March 23 at Triangle Business Journal's Women in Business Luncheon. Shooping Russell shared five key principles she had learned along the way. Stand for something. Have a few key issues in your personal and professional life that are important to you and remain true to them. Take risks, but risks can be alluring, so know your limits. Have fun. As poet Michael McPhee said, fun is waiting to be had. Wait out the storm until you can't. There always will be hard times, and sometimes it pays to be patient. Love passionately. Feel deeply and don't hold back. To me, to love intensely is a gift, she said, adding it was about more than romantic love. It is a risk that is worth taking. And now we turn to the On Technology and Banking page written by Lauren Onasorge. The first headline, North Carolina's biggest data breaches so far. Thousands of potential data breaches have been reported to the state in 2018, and that's just through March 20. After a public records request, the North Carolina Department of Justice disclosed reports of 217 data breaches, potentially impacting more than 280,000 North Carolinians since January 1. In 2017, 1,022 data breaches were reported to NCDOJ. According to the records, these five notices received in 2018 impact the most North Carolinians as of March 20. In all cases, the companies say they've taken measures to stop any fraudulent activity and that those impacted have been notified. Deli Management, doing business as Jason's Deli, 246,400 North Carolinians. The sandwich maker told the state January 17th of a breach discovered December 22, where payment processors notified the company that credit card information on the dark web may have come from some of their locations. Fast Health Corporation, 10,626 North Carolinians. The vendor, which provides website services on behalf of providers, notified the state February 27 that it had received a report from law enforcement on November 2 indicating that an unauthorized third party may have accessed its databases. Catawba County, 8,280 North Carolinians. Catawba County, which includes Hickory, told the state it learned of suspicious activity within PeopleSoft, its human resources and payroll system. It discovered malware through a third-party forensic investigator and notified the state February 28th that Social Security numbers, financial account information, and names and passwords of county employees and dependents may have been compromised. Guaranteed Rate, 5,725 North Carolinians. Guaranteed Rate notified the state of a phishing scheme January 12 that it had discovered September 13. Unknown actors had attempted to contact Guaranteed Rate borrowers by email, instructing them to wire mortgage closing funds through fraudulent instructions. They were successful in a number of cases, and Guaranteed Rate elected to reimburse the remaining impacted borrowers who were unable to recover their lost funds. And Winston Williams Creech Evans & Company, 1,395 North Carolinians, the accounting firm discovered an unauthorized party had logged into its electronic records via stolen login credentials February 5, possibly accessing tax files with Social Security numbers and other personal information between January 27 and February 4. Remote access was shut down and the state was notified February 23. RTI International spins out another startup. Research Triangle Park-based RTI International is spinning out a new company, SWIR Vision Systems. The firm will commercialize infrared camera technology being developed at RTI, research with potential applications in the industrial machine vision, security systems, agricultural, automotive, and other markets. The March 27 announcement marks the fourth time RTI has spun out a startup. Here's a look at its record. Ziptronics, Inc., spun out of RTI in 2000 to provide low-temperature wafer bonding technology for three-dimensional integrated circuits. The firm raised nearly $40 million in outside capital and even secured a high-profile licensing deal with electronics giant Samsung before being acquired by Tessera Technologies in August 2015 for $39 million. Nextstream Thermal Solutions Incorporated spun out of RTI as AnswerTech Incorporated in December 2004 to provide thin film thermoelectric technology, acquired by Laird PLC in February 2013 in a deal worth up to $60 million. Early work on the technology, as with SWIR, was funded in part by a grant from the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Sixis Incorporated spun out of RTI as BCO Incorporated in June 2008 to provide silicon integrated circuit board technology for reconfigurable computing. But despite capital raises from firms such as InterSouth Partners, the company was unable to survive the recession. RTI reacquired certain IP assets of the company in August 2010. And SWIR Vision Systems Incorporated spun out of RTI in March 2018 to provide shortwave infrared, or SWIR, SWIR, camera technology. Bigger deals mark Red Hat's record-setting quarter. Red Hat's latest quarter was all about the deal. CEO Jim Whitehurst told analysts March 27 that 169 of Red Hat's fourth-quarter deals broke the million-dollar mark. Of those, 26 were greater than $5 million, 14 were greater than $10 million, and two were greater than $20 million. In an interview after the earnings call, Red Hat Chief Financial Officer Eric Shander says Raleigh played a crucial part in the firm's deal-making in fiscal 2018. As our company is becoming much more strategic with our customers, the deal size is certainly getting much larger, he says. And when you think about Raleigh, we've got all functions of the company represented. A lot of the heart of what happens with the company happens out of Raleigh. The firm reported $2.9 billion in revenue for fiscal 2018. First Citizens wins injunction in bank dispute. After more than a week of deliberations, the North Carolina Business Court ruled in favor of Raleigh-based First Citizens Bank Shares efforts to suspend Smithfield-based KS Bancorp's poison pill provision, at least while the litigation between the banks continues, calling the provision, which KS enacted to ward off First Citizens share purchases, an unlawful mechanism. Judge Gregory McGuire approved a preliminary injunction March 21, barring KS Bancorp from taking any action under its shareholder rights plan or from adopting any similar provision while the litigation is pending. First Citizens filed its lawsuit over the provision February 15th, months after two failed takeover attempts. First Citizens then filed an application with the Federal Reserve for permission to purchase up to 80% of KS's common stock, but its plans were stopped in its tracks by the KS board's new rights plan. And finally, Durham-based lotion makers look to add cash. 3 years after unveiling their flagship product, a $14.95 lotion aimed at making your hands less sweaty, a pair of Triangle entrepreneurs are trying to raise some serious cash for their Durham company. Casper Kubica and David Sprate, the entrepreneurs behind Carpe Lotion, formerly called Clutch, are trying to raise nearly $1.7 million, according to a securities filing. Kubica and Sprate, who were students at Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill, respectively, when they founded their firm, already had $100,000 capital infusion from Thundershirt backer, Durham-based Bootstrap Advisors, which was enough to get their product off the ground. Fast forward to today, and the antiperspirant lotion is being sold online with 647 reviews on its Amazon listing and on the shelves at several Harris Teeter stores. And now we turn to Jennifer Henderson's page on life sciences, helping patients threatened by colds. For Durham-based Chimerix, fighting a virus known to cause the common cold is not a task it takes lightly. The company is currently setting up sites for a Phase 2 clinical trial of its lead antiviral drug, brincidivivor, for the treatment of adenovirus in pediatric transplant patients. The common virus is typically treated with over-the-counter medications, but for patients with a weakened immune system, it can be serious and even fatal, says Chimerix president and CEO, Dr. Michelle Berry. In fact, data presented by Chimerix at the annual meeting of the European Society of Blood and Marrow Transplantation in Lisbon, Portugal, showed that 1 in 3 pediatric stem cell transplant recipients in a recent study developed an adenovirus infection within 6 months of transplant. The data also showed that there was a greater than tenfold risk of mortality in those recipients with the highest levels of the virus. The goal with brincidivivir is to decrease the amount of virus in the blood very quickly, Berry says. Chimerix started setting up the first sites for the clinical trial in December, she says, and will continue enrolling to 30 to 35 sites in the U.S. and Europe for the next couple of months. The company expects to see data from the 140-patient trial in the second half of next year, and the program could lead to the company's first approval of a drug for clinical use. Chimerix is also developing brincidivivir for the treatment of human herpes viruses and smallpox, and it's developing another candidate for the treatment and prevention of norovirus. The company employs 80 people in Durham and 3 in Europe, where Berry says it will build out further soon, as it believes its first launch will be in Europe. Asheville Healthcare System looks to be acquired. Following the failure of UNC Healthcare and Atrium Health to combine, Asheville-based Mission Health is gearing up for a deal of its own. Mission has inked a letter of intent to enter exclusive discussions to join HCA Healthcare of Nashville, Tennessee. HCA Healthcare has 179 hospitals and about 1,800 outpatient facilities in 20 states and the UK. We're anticipating a due diligence period of 90 to 120 days, says Mission President and CEO Dr. Ronald Paulus, with the signing of a definitive agreement in late summer. With a 90-day regulatory review slated to follow that agreement, the deal could complete in late 2018. The deal would be subject to review by the Federal Trade Commission and NC Attorney General Josh Stein, he notes. HCA's lack of a presence in North Carolina is expected to aid in FTC review. Mission Board of Directors member Tom Oreck says the time was right for the deal given the tremendous pressure from the government and payers on cost. In October, P and Mission reached an agreement to place Mission back in the network after it canceled its contracts with Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina earlier in the year, claiming payment rate reductions from the insurer made it impossible to keep up with costs. Oreck says consolidation in healthcare has and will continue. We realize consolidation was not an if question, but a when question, he says. Mission, which serves 18 counties in western North Carolina, selected HCA for a number of reasons, Oreck says. First of all, he says HCA has the resources to aid in improving and providing quality care. And second, from a financial perspective, the deal is not only slated to create a foundation that will provide tens of millions of dollars each year to support people served in western North Carolina, but also millions of dollars in tax revenue not previously seen, as Mission is a nonprofit system. Fennec receives new FDA designation, readies for commercial launch. On the heels of securing fast-track designation from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for its lead drug candidate, Fennec Pharmaceuticals has received breakthrough therapy designation. The new designation signals that the company, based in Research Triangle Park, provided enough preliminary clinical evidence to the FDA that PEDMARK, which aims to prevent hearing loss in child cancer patients treated with chemotherapy, may be significantly better than treatments that are currently available. It still comes with the same benefits of the fast-track designation, which essentially provides for closer collaboration with the FDA and priority review. The company reported quarterly and full-year financial results March 26, including upward of $28 million in cash as it eyes commercial launch. Fennec said that it had cash and equivalents of $28.3 million as of December 31. That's following a pair of equity financings last year, facilitated in part by a move to the NASDAQ exchange, which it believes will be sufficient to fund the planned commercial launch of PEDMARK in the second half of next year. Fennec reported a net loss of $7 million last year, compared to a net loss of $2.8 million the year prior. Research and development expenses jumped from about $500,000 in 2016 to $1.9 million last year, largely due to expenses related to the planned commercialization of PEDMARK, according to the company. Fast-growing Durham firm acquires Fellow CRO. Durham-based contract research organization Turgis Pharma, which clocked in at number 219 on the Inc. 5000 list of fastest-growing companies in 2016, has acquired CRO InDev Laboratories, based in Kannapolis, for an undisclosed price. The deal officially closed earlier in March, says Turgis CEO Vijendra Nalamothu, and will see InDev's 26-person staff transition to Turgis while remaining based at existing space on the North Carolina Research Campus in Kannapolis. Prior to the deal's closing, Turgis employed about 75 people. And we're adding more people to handle the growth that we're seeing, says Nalamothu, noting that there are a number of open positions in the Triangle as well as Kannapolis. Both Turgis and InDev are focused in the niche area of dermatology. Turgis says the deal adds early phase development and capabilities, including skin biology. Nalamothu says that Turgis always stays open to acquiring more entities, but that it is also primed for organic opportunities moving forward. The deal between Turgis and InDev is the latest in a continually consolidating CRO industry as players look to pick up new capabilities and add market share in a maturing market. And finally, in a section called He Said It, the quote, "The strategic view of this is that there are regions of the world where it would be very difficult for us to do direct business." And that's from John Ryall, CEO of Morrisville-based Metabolon, on the company's international expansion path with the opening of a new lab in China. The move is a joint lab with Zhejiang Dian Diagnostics Company Limited in Hangzhou. And now we turn to Ben Graham's page on real estate. Analyst: NC undersells key assets in economic development. Despite all of the financial incentives and jet-setting handshakes North Carolina leaders have taken to woo companies, the state might be underselling itself when it comes to one of its perceived weaknesses, logistics infrastructure. Charlotte Douglas International Airport has expansive air cargo capabilities, linking truck and rail service to major hubs around the globe, and the fastest-growing ports in the country are located in neighboring states. Those attributes should be more than enough for the state to land some of the country's most sought-after projects, such as the Toyota Mazda assembly plant that recently went to Alabama, according to Kiernan K.C. Conway, chief economist of the Certified Commercial Investment Member Institute, or CCIM. You guys should absolutely be kicking butt in terms of logistics and transportation, Conway said to commercial real estate professionals during a recent visit to Cary for a CCIM forecast event. And you need to tell that story and not lose any more Toyota Mazda deals. That hasn't been the message from state officials, who suggested that a lack of supply chain logistics and distance from this infrastructure is what scuttled the Toyota Mazda pitch. But Conway said North Carolina is in a prime location for rail transport, with lines connecting the southeast region to major ports and the rest of the country. Charlotte's air cargo capabilities also shouldn't be overlooked. He calls it the logistics jewel because Charlotte's air cargo facilities are centrally located within the main airport. Many airports are heading away from that model, prioritizing passenger service. Ports are another critical factor, Conway said, and North Carolina is notably behind Charleston, South Carolina, and Norfolk, Virginia. Conway said North Carolina should be partnering with its neighbors, especially South Carolina, because North Carolina's skilled workforce is something it can offer in exchange for help with its port problem. Senior living with a twist cleared for construction in Cary. Yet another senior living home is cleared for construction in Cary, but this one comes with a twist. Sing Development, the Michigan company behind the Walton Wood Senior Living Facilities, has finalized the $5.5 million purchase of 22 acres at Cary Parkway and Evans Road. The theory behind this community is that we can have multiple generations living really close to each other, Sing Senior Vice President Mike Cam says. That means multifamily units and townhomes for millennials and their empty nester parents, and an adjacent senior home for the grandparents. The development will sprawl across two separate parcels on either side of Cary Parkway. Singh already owns a 19.2-acre tract south of the road. Construction on the multifamily portion is slated to begin next spring, while work on the townhomes and senior living component would likely start the following year, Com says. This will be Singh's 15th Walton Wood community and second in Cary. Another opened 7 miles to the south, also along Cary Parkway, in 2010. Singh has already received zoning approvals for its latest Cary project and has submitted site plans to the town for review, including land. The multifamily component is expected to cost $43 million, while the senior living and townhomes will ring in at $50 million. Apex Apartments, dating to 1988, sold for $43 million. A spree of apartment acquisitions across the triangle by outside investors has reached into western Wake County with the recent $43.45 million sale of the Lake Cameron Apartments. Fogelman Properties of Memphis, Tennessee, purchased the complex through a joint venture with New York-based DRA Advisors, according to a company statement. The sales price for the 328-unit community, built in 1988, breaks down to $132,317 per unit. That price is on the lower end compared to recent multifamily deals, but is on par with or even slightly above complexes of a similar age. Crossroads North Hills dates to 1985 and sold in late 2017 for $113,300, while Lexington on the Green, built in 1973, sold around the same time at $85,900 per unit. Fogelman plans to upgrade the units and the common areas. Details sketchy so far on new Chapel Hill Hotel. Few details are available on a new hotel planned for Chapel Hill, aside from a brief posting on the website of its management company that says a boutique Marriott brand is in development. The hotel under the chain's Moxie brand would be managed by Atlanta-based Hotel Equities. A spokeswoman says it's too early to comment on the project and that it could even be on hold. Chapel Hill Economic Development Officer Dwight Bassett could provide no details on the hotel either, except to say no plans have been filed with the town yet, but he says he has fielded two calls in recent months from developers looking to bring hotels to specific properties in downtown Chapel Hill. Until recently, those kinds of phone calls were exceedingly rare. I think this is a reflection of growing interest in the market, both from businesses and visitors, Bassett says. After Raleigh debut, couple plans to add two more Triangle franchises. A co-working space provider that recently debuted in Raleigh has plans to grow with at least two more facilities in the area. Raleigh couple Tara and Greg Abernathy opened their first Office Evolution franchise in November on Glenwood Avenue, located on the second floor of the First Tennessee building and taking up a total of 6,500 square feet. The space was previously occupied by Boss, or Byron Office Space Solutions. The couple bought out the company and inked a new lease. Tara Abernathy says they are in negotiations for another space in Cary, with a third location to be announced later. At the Glenwood Avenue location, there are 25 furnished offices, dedicated desks, a community kitchen, a business lounge, and two conference rooms. Rent for dedicated office costs $499, while a larger office suite costs $999, she says. We think that we have something unique to offer the co-working industry, she says. We hope to continue to grow and dominate the market here. We think Office Evolution is that good. The deal is part of a growing trend of co-working companies making inroads in the Triangle, including major lease deals recently signed in prominent locations, such as WeWork's lease for 58,000 square feet at the 27-story One City Center Tower in downtown Durham, and another 81,000 square feet in downtown Raleigh's One Glenwood building. And now as we move into some general news, here's an article written by Dane Huffman, the headline, Cooper Optimistic on CSX, Panthers, and NC Jobs. Governor Roy Cooper expressed optimism about CSX plans for Eastern North Carolina, confidence about the future of the Carolina Panthers, and echoed concerns CEOs have about finding the talent for jobs in an interview with the Triangle Business Journal and a sister publication. Cooper, in a 45-minute conversation with TBJ at the Executive Mansion on March 23, addressed a number of issues critical to the business community. In Eastern North Carolina, jobs are in short supply, which is why the $272 million CSX terminal was called a game changer after it was announced in 2016, and why the state has scrambled after CSX pivoted from its hub and spoke business model. Cooper said negotiations are ongoing with CSX over a planned intermodal terminal in Rocky Mount. When the company changed directions, then those projects were canceled across the country, Cooper said. He said he made phone calls to say that CSX can still have a major role in North Carolina with an intermodal hub. North Carolina Department of Transportation, as well as local officials in Rocky Mount, also called CSX, and the rallying has been effective, Cooper said. We are in ongoing discussions with CSX, he said, noting the project is still intermodal, meaning massive cargo loads would shift from trucks to trains and vice versa. He said he expects a significant investment there from CSX. He hopes for a decision pretty soon. Pro sports changing in NC. Carolina Panthers owner Jerry Richardson is selling the team, and Bloomberg has reported SAS Institute CEO Jim Goodnight is interested. I have not talked to him about that, but I have heard his name in conjunction with that, Cooper said. He certainly can afford it. Cooper says he can envision a scenario where an owner would want to move the Panthers out of the state. Whoever it is, if they're from North Carolina, they'll know what they've got, and if they aren't, they'll find out, he said. Football isn't the only sport on Cooper's radar. When asked about the effort to bring Major League Soccer to Raleigh, he says there have been discussions about locating a stadium at state-owned property off P Street. Local officials would have to be involved in that process as well, he said. The Department of Administration has looked at it, Cooper said. He said he saw merit to public-private partnerships and mixed use, but added, it has to be well thought out. I'm not sure they had a real plan going forward. That's one of the things the Department of Administration is looking at. Preparing North Carolina workers for jobs. Cooper said that in his many conversations with CEOs, a key concern they have is finding the right workers to fill jobs they have available. Most companies have jobs open and lots of them, he said. We need to be working to fill the jobs available. He said the North Carolina Job Ready Plan announced February 13 is designed to train and educate North Carolinians for good-paying jobs. He said a key point is changing the mindset that young people to go to a four-year school. You don't have to go to school for 4 years to get a great paying job, he said. North Carolina gun manufacturer files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. This article is written by Luke Bollinger for the Triad Business Journal. After announcing in February it would restructure and enter into bankruptcy protection, Remington Outdoor Company said March 26 it has filed its restructuring plan under Chapter 11 of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code to reduce about $775 million of the company's debt. Remington filed its reorganization package with the United States Bankruptcy Court for the District of Delaware and expects to complete the process within 45 to 60 days. Once the company has emerged, it expects to have canceled its $775 million in debt and raised $155 million of new funds, in addition to a $193 million in a rollover asset-based lending facility. Remington Outdoor Company, the holding company formerly known as the Freedom Group, is one of the world's largest manufacturers of firearms and ammunition, including such brands as Remington, Bushmaster Firearms, DPMS, Panther Arms, Marlin, H&R, the Parker Gun, Tapco, Advanced Armament Corporation, Dakota Arms, Nessica, Stormlake, Timbersmith, and Barnes Bullets. The Remington name is also one of the industry's oldest, dating back more than 200 years to the founding of Remington Arms by Eliphalet Remington II in New York. Remington is headquartered in Madison, which is located in Rockingham County and near the Virginia border. The original reorganization plan detailed in February entailed $145 million in debtor-in-possession financing. The official plan now includes the $193 million asset-based loan, bringing the total financing up to $338 million to assist the company through restructuring. The financing provided to Remington from its lenders and shareholders will allow the company to continue day-to-day operations uninterrupted. Remington CEO Anthony Esitelli said the company will be positioned to grow our business and find new opportunities. Third quarter sales in 2017 for the company were $154.1 million, down 30.4% from $221.7 million reported in the same quarter a year ago. For three quarters ended October 1, the company reported a loss of $60.5 million compared with net income of $19.5 million from three quarters ended in 2016. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page, where we start with the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, who's editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Missed Playoffs Spell Deeper Local Impact. With a handful of hockey games left, it looks like the Carolina Hurricanes will once again miss the National Hockey League playoffs. But this time, I fear the aftershock may be stronger, and that's because of the new owner, Thomas Dundon. Ever since Dundon took over the ownership of the Raleigh hockey team, he reiterated one thing over and over again. The team has to make the playoffs to regenerate the energy, passion, and financial strength to get deeply rooted to the community. Dundon also has said he is not a very patient man. Trying to right the ship, Dundon made several changes, capped by moving Hall of Famer Ron Francis from the general manager slot. But Dundon is well aware that if the team is unable to cross the playoff hurdle, almost none of his new initiatives will work. He keeps saying that an NHL game in Raleigh should not be just about hockey. It should be about entertainment. Well, he better start booking Justin Timberlake or Jerry Seinfeld to perform between periods. Statistics released by the NHL show the Hurricanes are ranked 29th among 31 teams in the league in terms of average attendance per game. With an average of 13,224 through 39 home games, the Canes actually rank last when the numbers are calculated on percentage of capacity at the PNC Arena, 70.8%. When former Hurricanes owner Pete Karmanos moved the team from Hartford, Connecticut some 20-plus years ago, Gale Force Holdings, the holding company of the hockey club, had to strike several agreements with entities such as NC State University, Centennial Authority, caretakers of the arena, and RBC Centura, the legacy company which sold to PNC Bank. PNC's 20-year, $80 million naming rights contract is up for renewal discussions in a couple of years. With the Canes missing the playoffs 8 years in a row and the arena sitting at 70% of capacity during hockey games, what are the chances PNC will be willing to commit another $80 million? Maybe NC State's basketball team will suddenly be a top-five powerhouse and be on national TV often? That certainly will change the equation. Also, Gale Force's lease with the Centennial Authority is through the 2024 and lease negotiations might begin this summer. I think Dundon surely will give it a couple more years to see if Raleigh can support this hockey team, but I think he will start making some major changes in the offseason, and it will start with hockey operations, because we all know he will not wait a nanosecond to move this team elsewhere if he is convinced the business model will not work for him in Raleigh. As I said, this year, the aftershock may feel stronger. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have an article written by Addie Tomer, who is a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings in Washington, D.C. The headline on his Viewpoint, "No Need to Throw Away AV Technology." Sometimes when a news story hits, you just know it will reverberate. The fatal collision involving an Uber autonomous vehicle, AV, hitting a pedestrian in suburban Phoenix fits that profile perfectly. While all details are not yet public, early reporting suggests the Uber AV hit someone crossing a street outside a designated crosswalk. As an initial response, Uber pulled all of its AV services from each city where it's testing. Yet beyond the personal tragedy, the events in Phoenix do nothing to change the broader context that existed the day before the collision happened. American roads are deeply unsafe. Transformative technology is coming, whether we like it or not, and the public must now enter a complex but essential debate about how we should integrate AV technology within the places where we live, work, and play. Any unnecessary death is a tragedy, but the collision in Phoenix was far from the only death on our streets that day. Over 100 people die in automobile-related crashes each day in America. In fact, there were 10 pedestrian deaths alone in the Phoenix area last week. Most years, these crashes represent the leading cause of death for people in their teens and 20s. It's appalling and a steep price to pay for our car-dependent geography, and since most of us drive every day, it's a tangible risk we all take. The promise of AV technology is to virtually eliminate this self-created scourge. The thinking is sound. When every car can communicate with each other, and when machine learning algorithms can capture the enormous range of interactions between vehicles and non-motorists, then we can manufacture vehicles that both get us where we need to go and ensure almost no one gets hurt in the process. Until the tragic event in Phoenix, the dream scenario of no true AV-related fatalities still felt possible. Besides a few minor nicks, nearly all of which were the fault of human drivers, Waymo, Ford, GM, Uber, and other companies working on AVs all achieved sterling safety records. But dream is the operative word, because perfect safety was never possible. We're still in the nascent stages of this new technology. There is no established algorithm for all scenarios. The testing companies don't share their code, nor is reporting consistent from state to state. And we're just now seeing AVs enter the more chaotic world of cities. It's one thing to automate driving on a well-striped, high-quality, cars-only road, but machine learning is harder when you add unpredictable people, poorly striped lanes, low-quality pavement, inclement weather, and other inconsistencies. Algorithms thrive on order, and city streets have less of it. When every car can communicate with each other, and when machine learning algorithms can capture the enormous range of interactions between vehicles and non-motorists, then we can manufacture vehicles that both get us where we need to go and ensure almost no one gets hurt in the process. Understandably, the public will respond to this new piece of information by debating the very existence of this new technology. There certainly will be calls to stop all AV testing, not just Uber's program. The Fuhrer could slow down other cities and states from authorizing testing, much like it could influence federal legislators to redraft portions of their AV legislation. But technological progress is hard to stop, and I don't expect it to happen in this case. AV simply offer too many transportation benefits. Greater long-run safety, hands-free travel, subscription-based models, new public revenue streams, and there is too much private investment already underway to keep them at bay. Instead, the truly challenging debate, the one that will last, will involve where to permit AVs to drive and how we reform other transportation and design laws in the process. It's not hyperbole to say every single rule and penalty related to transportation and street design could be upended within the next few decades. Sound fantastical? It already happened once within our grandparents' lifetimes. AV technology gives us a chance for a do-over. Our shared challenge, then, is to ensure AV technology works for us and not the other way around. First, that means local governments who control land use and their county and state partners who control many high-speed streets must figure out new ways to collaborate on purposeful place-based design. Second, specific land use and transportation decisions must formally relate back to those broader objectives. Finally, we must be ready to scrap every regulation we know related to vehicles and pedestrians. It's that big. The tragedy in Phoenix was ultimately inevitable, as the onset of AV's groundbreaking technology revolution would lead to an unpredictable tragedy at some point. And while the hope is AV performance will soon point to a safer future, let's make sure we use this specific tragedy to spark even broader long-term good. And in the TBJ Business Survey Pulse, the question was, should you have to be at least 21 to buy a gun in North Carolina? There were 200 respondents. The yeses were 72%. And the no's were 28%. And the remaining time will be on news stories. Raleigh Group buys Charlotte space slated for hotel. Another project could soon rise in uptown Charlotte's first ward following a recently closed land transaction. Concord Levine Hotels, LLC, affiliated with Raleigh-based hotel group Concord Hospitality Enterprises, recently purchased a 0.4-acre parcel at the corner of North College and East 8th Streets from LMC, the multifamily arm of Lennar Corporation that is developing a 549-unit apartment project on that same block. The portion of the site that Concord Hospitality acquired recently for $3 million was anticipated for hotel development. Concord Hospitality has 9 hotels in North Carolina listed as part of its portfolio, including a Homewood Suites on Charlotte's Yorkmont Road. Its other North Carolina hotels are in Raleigh, Durham, and Beaufort, although it does have other properties around the country. LMC isn't breaking ground on its mixed-use project until later this year. It will include a 33-story high-rise with 365 units and a 6-story, 184-unit mid-rise, as well as about 20,000 square feet of ground-floor retail fronting the Lenox Blue Line. LMC's project will occupy the rest of the block. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, feel free to give us a call. Our number is 919-832-5138.